Welcome to The Speckled Bees, a celebration of childhood. My name is Lucy.
I'm Spencer.
And this is the podcast where we talk about child development and supporting childhood through intentional teaching and curated experiences. I don't know, is that about it?
I like curated experiences because curating the environment that you want to give you the ideal learning setting. And that is, I mean, the biggest word I use with every introduction is passion. We have such a passion for curating these special moments. And we hope that we can vocalize those experiences and future ideas into one concise episode.
Concise after a lot of editing. All right. So today we are going to talk about real tools. So I've just been really enjoying talking about risky play. This is something that we both are going to have a lot to say on, I think. So we are going to talk about using real tools, and we're going to segue into more of woodworking tools. But I do want to start off with the benefits of just using real tools in general. Real tools tend to work better and last longer. They are made out of quality materials. They show the child we respect them, and they allow the child to have real experiences. And in a lot of these cases, using real tools provides a manageable risk, like we've been talking about. So examples of real tools to use with children, we talked about kitchen tools, musical instruments are a great one. My neighbors are so loud with their cars. Someone needs to fix their muffler. But yeah, so musical instruments is a really great one to use with children. Science tools, microscopes, magnifying glasses, pipettes.
And those are constantly being donated.
Yeah, they're not hard ones to find. And a lot of those things, you don't even need to find it in a child size. And we're going to talk about the importance of child size tools later. A lot of those, like a magnifying glass, you really can have a child use a bigger one. The smaller ones are nice, but it's not gonna interfere with their experience. And then I want to talk about some art tools. So some of the ones that I was thinking of is like needle and thread, brushes.
And I like that you included needle and thread because that's actually a specific one that I have a lot to say about.
Yeah, this is a free range. Talk about real tools in an art capacity.
Sure. Okay. So I went into an artistic field with the intention to do fine arts and on a production capacity, not an education capacity. There is a really big argument about the disparity of expenses and tools is that they require you to buy very nice materials because there is a strong and what I think is a correct belief that yes, it takes a good artist to use tools, but good tools can also make an artist. It makes a huge difference in amplifying the quality of your work and the respect you have for your work. If you have good tools, you will respect them more. I have so many feelings about this because I'm sick of low quality plastic materials used in most arts because kids feel willing to use and abuse them, throw them away easily. And it really takes away a lot of that value for the art that they're putting in. Invest in a nice horsehair brush. Invest in a nice wood brush. Don't invest in the plastic ones. But needles and threads, I especially have a big bane about because much like our conversations on risk and play, if the outcome outweighs the negative risk, it is worth investing in. And I, working in a child capacity, have had to fight tooth and nail many times to advocate for metal needles over the plastic ones. I'm actually going to include a picture when we upload this episode, Lucy, that I've shared with you of children using plastic needles. Those are fine if you're moving through open wefts. They don't go through fabric in any capacity. They bend, they break. I was doing a sewing embroidery unit with some kids last year. The quickness and to which toddlers were able to pick up the sewing back and forth motion, but the frustration that came with the thickness, the denseness of these plastic cheap needles was so frustrating for myself as the teacher and the children as the learner. And it was such a good example to me of how if we had had a proper needle, one that would have gotten the job done and really taught the child the value of that needle, I think the lesson would have been much more astute.
Yeah, I went to school with a girl that she in her lab did a did a whole sewing. I'll have to contact her and see if she has some pictures or things to say about it. But she did a lesson on sewing.
That's a good lesson. I mean, sewing is one of the most natural subjects. It's
a life skill. Like, it's really good, and it's good for the world to have this skill. It's good for the environment to be able to darn a sock instead of throwing it away, to sew up a little hole in your shirt instead of throwing it away. It's a really important skill to have, and children are capable of doing this. This is a very minimal risk, and you are probably going to poke your finger. I poke my finger a lot when I sew, but I'm a little careless. But this is not a mortal injury. It's a little injury that you could get through life in general. Things are pokey. You can get poked.
It's a learning experience. If you never get that small poke, you're never going to know that my needle is capable of going through some thicker weft. You know, you're going to know to avoid, to use, move your hand placement. There's so many educational parts of that. So a big part of it too is, and I say this a lot, it's imbuing trust. You'll see those videos constantly. And I love these videos because they're so funny, where parents will go, okay, you know, here's a teddy bear and here's a spatula. And which one will you pick? And the kid's like, oh my God, the spatula, like time and time again, because it's the item they see the adult using or the foreign item that has the sense of mystery. If we take that mystery away, we take away that sense of, you know, this is bad and I'm getting the chance to use, you know, that ooh, cheeky kind of thing. It gives more of a sobriety to the use of the object because they're kind of going, oh, I have this responsibility. I'm being given this trust. I should use it better. Needle and thread, great example of that.
Yeah, I agree. I was thinking also, going back to you talking about brushes, a lot of these materials are going to be more expensive, but they do last longer. They're more durable. So ultimately, you're causing less waste and they will last longer.
Right. Quality over quantity. Yeah. Brushes are made with natural hair fibers, synthetic fibers, or plastic fibers. Plastic are the worst. They remain bristle no matter what, and they're the cheapest. And often those are, I think everybody can picture this, those are those really skinny brushes that come primary colors with the heads that stand up like a fan at the top. And we're not talking a big, beautiful fan. We're talking the, more like a broom head. And it really, it makes such a difference because they will never give a refined point. They will always have a choppy lay when you're painting with them. I think there's a lot more value. I constantly do lessons on brush heads with kids because you can get a million uses out of three different brush heads, a pointed, a square top, and a wide top. Using a refined tool and telling kids the right way to use them can dramatically change the experience with the tool and the child's investment in the tool.
I love that.
I love when we work together, when we would interchange our tools, and I would specifically mention the leather working tools. Oh my gosh, what a fun set.
What a great way to make these more enriching experiences is using these tools in different capacities. Even you talked about using cleaning supplies in an art capacity.
I was literally going to mention that.
To change some of these, use these different tools in different realms than you normally see them, gives a whole new life. And so that's why it was so powerful, I think, not to toot our horns, but when we were able to work in tandem and have a bit where you did leather working and used engraving tools. And then soon thereafter, I used the same tools and we brought it into our woodworking.
I love those tools. They were specifically sold as a leather working set. And it was these thin metal rods with metal stamps of everything from moons to butterflies at the end. And it came with a mallet. And what you would do was you would pinch the stencil, the metal stencil between your fingers, apply the mallet firmly at the end of the stencil, and it would make an indent in your soft surface. So I used it for leather. And then the way that you used it, didn't you do pumpkins as well?
We did both. So we did a project that we started out, again, tooting my own horn, but this is a really good format to follow to use tools with children is that I introduced a different tool each time I was with the children and gave them practice using the tools. And then we used all of these different tools. They cut 4 pieces of wood. They nailed them together and we screwed them together to put some screws in there as well. And yep. We used the carving materials we used the engravers to put little stamps all around it. And then we used engraving tools to cut out designs as well. And then we ended up painting it a little bit as well. Mm-hmm. And then we did a mud painting on a sheet to put in the frame.
It's a beautiful piece of art, not even knowing the level of detail you went into every piece of it.
Yeah, the children worked on this project for months. Maybe not months, but yeah, I think it was months.
No, it was months. Yeah. Yeah.
And then kind of the end project of this, the capstone, was using those materials on pumpkins to carve pumpkins around Halloween time.
I miss you at the school.
I miss you too.
We just finished studying pumpkins and I was just thinking about that. We're a good team.
So,
and the more we talk about this, the more I think about every project I've ever done that has used a refined tool, because again, refining the tools that children use and not demeaning them to base level objects. I mean, there's one child, I think you know who I'm talking about. He knows how to use a drill and he's very proud of his drill because he uses it one-on-one with mom and dad at home. It's a very baseline tool that all of us should know how to use as adults. But it's fascinating that he was learning how to do this in the safety of his parents' supervision at such a young age of 3. It's just, it doesn't have to be brushes or, you know, drills and saws. It can also be tools that help around the house, like cleaning supplies and whatnot.
Right, right.
You know, I'm thinking about, okay, one of my favorite examples, because I'm trying to think of something that's a little more outside the box of an interesting artistic tool, is I had my children from as young as 2 do paper making.
Oh,
so yeah. The tools involved in this were sifters, and we made those out of metal grates and frames that had been stapled together, and blenders. We actually had the kids load the blender up. I would hold the top and they would press the button and blend their material. So we had a very strong discussion on, you know, respect of the blender. No touching it without the teacher present. And we would talk about measurement amounts, getting the appropriate amount in the blender. And that amazing awe when they made their own paper pulp. They had to shred the paper themselves, pick the appropriate colors, decide how to use that pulp. It was so satisfying because in the end, they made these crude but beautiful homemade paper pieces. It was fascinating. And as an adult, it was a hard tool to use. So the fact that these kids as young as 2 were doing it, because we gave them the tools to do so and the ability to do so, was amazing.
Right. Yeah. Oh, I love that. I wasn't there for the project that you did, but they were up for a while and it was so cool to see that the children did them.
They're still there. I won't take
them. Yeah, they're so cool. I think that part of it is we think of, oh, this is a hard task for me as an adult. Part of that is because we're adults and we're not as capable of learning. So it's a skill that is not something that we've practiced very much. It's new. It's uncomfortable to us, but a child does not come into it with those thoughts. Yeah, all of that self-doubt. And so if they think that, oh, well, this is what we're supposed to be able to accomplish here, they're often able to accomplish that thing as long as they have the proper tools. And I do want to give a disclaimer. There's nothing inherently wrong with having some of these plastic tools around as well. Like, right. You don't have to go and throw away everything in your house that is plastic. One of Leo's, we rotate our toys, and one of his toys that he has right now is this little toy that has balls, and you hit the balls through with a hammer and it's all plastic. It, like, nieces and nephews come over and use it and they love it. And he gets so much use, and he uses the plastic hammer often as like a golf thing, and he hits the balls around the room. And like, not saying you need to go and throw away every tool that you have that is plastic, but supplement it with real tools. Don't have that be the only thing right. that you're offering your child, because using a real tool is going to give them a very different experience, and they're capable of using these things. Real tools are more interesting, which naturally leads children to be more positively and constructively invested in whatever you're doing. They Agreed. Give children a sense of accomplishment and a desire for constructing, building, engineering, and creating. They heighten children's self-awareness, self-regulation, and self-control, as the consequences of misusing the tools are personal and real, which goes yeah. in. We talked about this very much in depth in just the original Risky Play episode. The fact that you have consequences, that there's a consequence of pricking your finger with a needle.
Right,
that is not just them learning not to prick themselves with a needle, but it helps them with proprioception. I love that word. Apparently, I use it a lot.
Wait. Say it again. Proprioception.
Yeah, proprioception. So, okay. like, it's an awareness of how one part of your body relates to the other part of your body.
I like that word. Yeah,
it's great. And then vestibular awareness, where mm-hmm. you are in space. Like, those things are, we learn as we're having sensory experiences in our environment. So this body awareness and self-awareness comes from consequences, comes from feedback from our environment. And these tools give you real feedback and real consequences. Real tools honor children's abilities and intelligence and sends a message that they are capable constructors and engineers. Right. Going back to Reggio roots, we respect children and their abilities. Real tools promote bonding experiences between children and adults. So have trust right. as you're working with these more high risk tools, you have a shared experience, and, we're going to talk about zona proximal development in a second, but yeah, it's all about zona proximal development.
I couldn't agree with that more, because that aspect of sharing tools and creating bonds with tools, cooking in a kitchen together, yeah. you know, it's, you see those pictures of the moms whisking with kids, or you hear the stories, and I've heard these so much as a joke, holding the flashlight for dad as he like fixes a car or something like that. It's using a tool to be a part of an adult experience, an adult task. It's just
I didn't even think of those examples, but yeah, I love that. I mean, we talk about cooking and stuff all the time, but yeah, I love that. Even with holding a flashlight is a really useful tool, and what a good one to integrate too. Flashlights, you know, one that actually works, one that actually clicks yep. on and clicks off instead of just like a play pretend one. Is nice to have. I like that. Okay.
Thanks.
Then they hone, grow some fine motor skills, obviously. Mm-hmm. And they do that better than play tools, because real weight, real feedback, all what we talked about.
Oh my gosh, big time. Yes. Mm-hmm. I mean, a hammer.
Yeah. Gosh. Yeah. Like,
what a solid example.
And it teaches you a bunch of physics as well too, like a plastic hammer. You don't realize why a hammer has to be as heavy until you're actually using a real hammer to hit a nail, and you need that force behind it. You understand how the world works.
I use hammers constantly in our art projects, especially because I have the older kids do their own installations. It's an outdoor project. They constantly underestimate how heavy the head is. Mm-hmm. That's the point. The head is very, they all hold the hammer with their hands at the base of the handle, and they're dropping it. And I'm like, you need to hold it at the top near the head. And they look at me like, are you kidding me? I've seen Bob the Builder, and Bob doesn't hold it like that. And I'm like, yes, well, Bob is a grown man.
Bob is a fake man.
So. Bob is a fake man. Right. And like, it's really funny to me, because you hear these constant jokes about how people in media will use, I don't know, like they'll use like driving a car in movies. It's not the way you really should. And that's another thing, is we should teach kids the proper way to use a tool so they don't misconceive it from maybe media examples.
Right.
Scissor safety is another thing too.
Oh, yeah.
I could get into that for ages. Oh,
yeah. So, scissors, not that you should give a 2-year-old a real scissors, but ones that actually cut. That drives me crazy when you have scissors in a classroom that are like real hardcore safety scissors where they don't actually even cut the paper.
The plastic.
Yeah. And you're just like,
they're meant for Play-Doh. They're not meant
And the children get so frustrated.
And frustration leads to bad and emotion-based choices. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Rough emotion-based choices. And that's another reason why I don't like the plot. Back to the plastic needles. Those drive me nuts. You're asking a child to complete an already difficult task with a blunt
with
object.
An incorrect tool, really.
Incorrect tool, yeah. Correct. Again, plastic scissors should only be used for cutting Play-Doh. Like that was their original intention. Or teaching grip, I suppose, if you really want to push it in that direction. I just did a whole thing with a class on how to properly hold scissors in both the appropriate way to put your fingers in, but also the appropriate way to walk with them. Mm. If you don't already know, it's you hold the blade, you're supposed to hold the blade in your hands. And only the plastic top is supposed to poke out from your hands. Same with adult scissors. It's the only safe way to really hold them. And I did a really fun demonstration for the kids of how if you fall over, but it's in your hand, you are safe when you're rolling. And they love that. So.
You didn't show the consequence of if you hold it the wrong way?
Yeah. It's true. It's you know, it's teaching them that there's real weight and real physical feedback when you inappropriately use or do not know how to appropriately use a material.
Right, exactly. And so my last one on this list, we pretty much have covered it, but they lead to real and meaningful experiences and other kind of study that crosses over into all realms of educational experience. Oh, this was a really wordy point. such as in science, nature, construction, engineering, math, language, literacy, and writing, which I guess I had a whole point on there, but that's what we talked about earlier, the crossover between all of these different skills and all of these different tools.
Mm-hmm. So that's your crossover.
So let's get in toward woodworking. You know that I love doing woodworking with children.
Me too. Love it.
So much fun. And they're capable of this sort of thing. Anyways, woodworking is a great way to have children work in their zone of proximal development. So I want to talk about this for a little bit. So this is Vygotsky. He's important. So this theory, the zone of proximal development, is there's a space between what the child can do alone and what a child can do with an adult or more experienced peer. And that is their zone of proximate development. Zone of proximal development. But if a child is only doing what they can do on their own, they're only going to learn to a certain point. You need to introduce those harder skills to push them. And that the zone mm-hmm. of proximal development is really the sweet spot for learning. It's a little bit past what they could just do on their own, but the cap is it's not, they're still able to accomplish it with an adult's help. With a peer's help, they still have to be able to accomplish it. And that's when they really learn the best. And so that really comes into play with woodworking. And honestly, anytime you're using a real tool, they're probably not going to use it right the first time. You have to exactly what you were talking about with scissors, to show them the right way to hold it. You know, if they just go and pick up this tool, they're often going to use it improperly and definitely often going to use it in an unsafe manner as well.
Right. At that point, it is not a tool. It is a toy.
Yes. Yes. And so that's where we step in to help make the crossover, help show them what to do and work with them until they can figure it out and then let them use the tool on their own.
I mean, to get really deep, that's kind of the definition of education. It's taking the unknown and applying a level of knowledge about the subject. So it's no longer in that category of unknown. It's in the category of I'm becoming a mild officiant on this subject matter. And I believe you had many children that you worked on woodworking at a light level with that really picked that up on a large scale, like took a keen interest in that subject.
Yeah. I also did love being in collaboration with you on that, because the children would come to me having just done this with the leather working and they already knew the physics of the hammer. And so I had to work with a couple of children, but most of the children stepped up to the plate and immediately knew what to do. And that helped us be able to accomplish a lot more because we weren't spending all our time working on each one of these tools. Some of the tools we were able to breeze through a little more. So something like saws, which we used the saws, and that used a lot more direct attention, one-on-one from me, and a lot more instruction on how to move it. And so we could spend just one day on the hammer and have a lot more time to work on saws.
Yep. No. And when you told me you were working with saws, I was so enchanted because it was such a lovely way to get kids involved in something that I wish I'd known how to do when I was a kid. I mean, can we all be honest? There was many things that when we grew up, we all have had those, oh, I'm an adult now moments, whether it was taxes, driving a car, you know, your first time cooking could even be one. I didn't learn how to use a saw until I was in woodworking and art college, especially like electronic saws. It's just, unless you have been given that explicit experience, some of us don't have that opportunity. Imagine if your kid was given that opportunity and that learning experience at a young age. What a boon of knowledge for a lifetime they will have.
Yeah, I agree. There's just, I like I mentioned in one of those points up before, children are so engaged in these sorts of activities when you're giving them the trust. Like that was not a hard nature class to do, to get children to pay attention to and honestly to listen. And it was very easy to set a boundary of today we're using some tools that have a lot more risk, that you could get hurt very easily. So if you are not listening to what I am saying, you do not going to participate in this activity today. And I did not have problems with that.
No, and it really works out. That comes to a nice level of how do you safely monitor and direct these activities. If you lay out strong guidelines and enforce strong guidelines of responsibility and consequence, that is another way of handling professional tools with young children. Because, you know, we both had experiences with doing a more refined tool element where there has been a close, unfortunately, I'm going to be blunt, a close call maybe. And the important thing is just to make sure that you have a stern and very clear conversation about why this might have happened and how you can avoid future negative outcomes from tool use.
Yes, for sure. And I have a list of tips for adults. And I did not even include that. I did not include that. Obviously, if you're going to put in a risk, you need to, and this is a little bit of a different kind of risk too. I'm glad that we're talking about this separately than big body play. Big body play is really easily self-regulated because they've been using their body and they have more body awareness. When you add in different tools, it makes it a little bit more complicated. And so they do need a couple more boundaries because you're introducing a foreign object. But yes, so we've talked about like hammers and nails, saws, hand drills. Excellent way to incorporate this with children is not necessarily the electric drills, but there's those hand drills.
Yeah, those are great. Yeah,
I don't know how to describe it in any of other ways.
Lucy's making a fun crank motion right now that reminds me of butter churning.
Yeah, like a crank drill. Yeah, but yeah, screws, screwdrivers, nuts and bolts is a good one. And that's a way to incorporate a real tool with less risk to it. And then carving tools we talked about.
Fantastic. Yep. If I had to throw mine into it, it's sewing tools. It's a classic. It's an easy one. I would lightly throw in using scissors with a directive. So collage making. So giving glue scissors in one big full swoop so that they can cut out specific interests from media sources, newspapers, magazines, etc., and glue those in a specific manner. I think that's a great like tool to master. Think about how many times as adults we cut and glue things. It's a very refined skill.
I also love that idea. And that is so regio of putting out invitations
Oh, yes. Invitation to play.
Yeah, there are invitations to play. When you give the child all the tools that they need to accomplish a certain task. And I think it is a powerful lesson when you have something that really engages all of the children's attention. I think sometimes we get so frustrated with children's behavior that I'm trying to think of a polite way to say this. I hope nobody who's involved in the circumstance listens to this and gets mad at me. But I was helping out in a classroom one time, and they were having a problem with getting a child to come to circle time. And one day we'll talk about circle time, and I'll share some of my feelings about circle time, what is appropriate for circle time, and whether or not circle time is even appropriate at all. And I don't know that I necessarily think that it is, but I'll get a lot of hate for that. But they were struggling with a child coming to circle time. And this is a child.
It's a hard directive.
Yeah. Right. And this is a child that has a hard time. He has challenging behaviors a lot. And I think that this classroom had almost, and this is, again, not accusing anyone, because this is such, every teacher has fallen into this pattern of just a child has challenging behaviors. So you don't go through the process of stepping back and realizing your role in their challenging behavior, so to speak. So they did.
What you're talking about, because I've seen it many times. And I've been a part of it many times.
Right. And anyway, so I had got him into circle time, and it's still a pretty big struggle to keep him. But he like came willingly to circle time once I worked with him a second. But he then did not stay in circle time. And luckily, the teacher I was working with, the teacher who was in that classroom stopped. And she is an amazing teacher, but she kind of brought up the situation, and she was like, what do you think? We've not been making him come to circle time, and you kind of made him come today. Like, what are some ideas that you have? And I was like, don't take offense to this, but why would he have come to circle time? It was really boring. There was nothing there to engage him. So why would he come over? And that I was able to get him to come over, but then they were doing calendar time and things like that, that again, that I don't necessarily think are appropriate to do, but
I think there's appropriate ages and
yes. And those are not, I think routine is important. I think that
routine is very important,
but some of these things to make a child sit and listen to a boring thing, that's not going to increase behavior. That's, you're going to get into a fight, an unnecessary fight with, it's an unnecessary conflict.
I'm so careful about my two cents that I add on subjects like this, because I have the blessing to be the fun time teacher. I'm the one who comes in and I come in for 45 minutes for a lesson, and I get to be that fun break in the routine. But I personally make a conscious choice with every class whether or not I will do a morning meeting. If I have a class that is sitting ready and the attentions are grabbed and it seems that they are inclined, I have my good morning songs. I usually have a book introduced, a media, a speech. I've got all of this ready to go. On the flip side, if I walk into a classroom and the interests are obviously skewed, there's something going on, there's a really fun subject matter, I'm not going to make them sit for that. I will skip the song very likely. I will jump right into the lesson. I want to make sure that the way I'm basing my lesson is based on the energies. I want to match the energies. And I love that term, actually, matching energies. I use that with adults too. I think it's a really important thing to keep in mind is you can't always make every situation work your way in both education levels and adult levels. Sometimes you have to be flexible and let go of certain things, you know, and back to tools. I mean, the same thing is there will be situations where maybe you can go into an in-depth lesson on a tool, and there might be situations where you have to be a little more monitoring of the tool and a little less hands-on, or it's all about gauging situations.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. And I love that you said the word flexibility, some variation of that. But
love that word.
Exactly what I was thinking. We get so mad at children for not being flexible when we often are not flexible ourselves. I've had similar situations where, I prepare things ahead of time, and I've had many times that I shut a book in the middle of a book and have to be like,
oh, totally. Yes.
You guys have too much energy to be sitting and reading this book today. And
totally.
Your bodies are telling you that you need to move, and me telling you that you have to sit still right now is not working. So let's stop this and let's go play. But yeah, bringing it back in to woodworking, using real tools. This is things that are going to actually engage our children.
Right.
If they're not participating in our activities, we need a change instead of just getting in this headbutting situation of
headbutting.
Yeah. You're not doing the activities that I planned for you to do. This is your problem. It's often it's our problem.
As a child who was quote unquote, and I hate labeling myself as this, and we've discussed this before, being neurodivergent in your thought process. As a child who was always told, stop moving, pay attention, I'm trying my best to make an effort to recognize that sometimes the reason a child is not sitting crisscross applesauce bottoms on the ground, hands in lap, is because they are physically incapable of that. We have to remember this. I mean, they're kids. The energy levels are through the roof. And where we may not have that energy, the kids just might.
Yeah. Yeah.
We need to be patient with that.
Right. And not taking it personally. It's not like,
Oh, not taking it personally.
Yeah. We are boring inherently. And I think sometimes you have a lot of guilt as a teacher who has challenging behavior and being like, oh, well, I don't like thinking of it as, me being boring, because that hurts. But it's not that we're boring people. It's that we're being boring in that moment. We're not, what we planned is not engaging for them that day. They might not be in the right spot. They might not have the right energy for what we're doing.
Yeah. Nobody is everybody's cup of tea. Okay. Another fun tool example and a fun story on exactly the subject. I introduced in May of this year Gyotaku fishing to the kids. And this is a kind of redundant to what we're talking about. It was using fake fishing rods, but real nets to catch fake rubber fish that replicated a very advanced tool where Japanese fishers in the early 13th to 18th century would catch, and I'm sorry if I'm misquoting those dates, but anyways, they would catch fish, they would slap some ink on them, and they would print them onto paper to literally record their fish pre-cameras, and when it was too hard to quickly write down a weight or a size or a length. And then it later got refined to a fine art form where samurais would catch fish and put great art into painting and recording the fish. So it wasn't just a quick, measuring contest. It was actually an art form. But we had the kids doing this. I like to have an interactive activity that pairs with art activity so that if a child is not interested in the art, they do have an option that is related to the art and gleans that information into them. Gyotaku was a huge example of that. We had quite a few young children. I was about to say boys, but it wasn't all boys, that were quite keen on physical aspects of art and did not like the smaller forms. And there's this one child, for the 3 weeks we did Gyotaku printing, did not touch the paint. He was into the fishing. He would sit on a stump, he would fish, and he was so into it. Like the collecting of the shells that I put in, the catching of the fish, and that is fine. If he did not want to do the art with me, I'm not going to make him. I'm just happy he was having the experience. I think we need to be a little more patient, unfortunately or fortunately, with the children that we work with the children that we're raising, because they're not going to share our interests all the time. And if we want to keep their interests for the future, we need to be patient with the ones that they do not share with us.
I love that. I love it. Going back to the whole child, woodworking addresses the whole child and promotes each category of learning development. So often it's broken down into three or four categories: social, emotional, physical, cognitive. And honestly, most of these can be attributed to all different types of real tools that we've been talking about. So social, emotional, it gives them a sense of competence when they're able to create something with these tools. So a sense of competence, confidence, responsibility, respect for self and others, and respect for materials and safety. Going back to even the conversation about the plastic brushes, the really cheap brushes, they treat these tools that aren't respectful tools to their capabilities in a disrespectful way a lot of the time.
And I will concur with that, is we have been harking on the nice materials, but if it is a breakable nice material, there can be a bit of discerning in how and what you purchase. Like, obviously, right, don't buy like don't buy a fancy $50 paintbrush, which there are plenty of those for a young child who's just going to smash it down. And I'm going on and on about these plastic brushes, and I still don't like them. I still will not use them. I'm not saying give like a baby one of the nice horsehair brushes. I'm going to use like blunt head brushes, and I'm going to use old brushes with a baby.
Right.
It's just plastic ones. Come on, guys. They're so bad. They will never get a point.
Yeah. They're not using this, or they're not going to glean the skill that they need to learn from it.
A big part of proper tool use is the cleaning of the tools, the maintenance of the tool. Proper tool usage also goes along with proper care of tools. So that's a question that should be asked, is perhaps, is your child old enough to use this tool if they are old enough to take care of this tool? Like, I think a hammer goes into younger ages because the care of a hammer is putting it away. A nice brush, can your child run it under a sink? Like, it's things like that.
What an awesome point. I love that. That's such a good...
Oh, thank you.
Very, very specific guidance that I think that a lot of us crave.
Yeah.
And I was just kind of going to go with just being aware it's never a bad thing. Doesn't make you a bad teacher to pull up the actual checklist of milestones. Yeah.
The only one I've gotten into recently, and I've seen recently because of personal experiences in the classroom, scissors and sharpeners. Mm-hmm. Both of which the appropriate age, and this is by the recommendation, the pediatric recommendation is 3, just because you're better refining logical skills, such as I am aware of the risk and the outcome if I misuse this tool, starts to develop at the age of 3. So that's one thing to keep in mind too. And I like having this conversation with every transitioning 2 to 3 year old parent, is the big difference between the terrible 2s and the 3s. Is terrible 2s are quote unquote terrible because that's when the logic side is of reasoning and recognition is starting to develop. Kids are suddenly going, wait, I can argue. I can make a point. I can make my point on things. And at the age of 3, it's when they start to refine that argumentative side of their brain and turn it into refined recognition of I can do this. And so scissors and sharpeners really start to become a more regular tool. That's another refined tool. A pencil sharpener. Those are so important. I used to hate having those around classrooms. And now I understand why they're so important. If we're just talking about a necessary tool, what's the point in giving a child a pencil if you are controlling them by only allowing them to use a pencil colored or graphite when it is sharpened? You are limiting them because they can't do anything with that tool if they don't have access to a sharpener to make that tool usable. So I was reading a whole study once about how you are inherently cutting your child off by not providing them a sharpener because you're forcing them to rely on you and bug you when that pencil becomes dull. And if you would like them to have independency, you should consider things like sharpeners and of the ability to access their own cleanup tools. Like, you know, dish soap should be at an accessible level, I would argue, above the age of 3 so that they can wash their brushes and whatnot, so that they're not coming up to you and saying, please do this because I physically can't.
I do like that.
Thanks.
I also love these conversations because sometimes they're a little humbling, I guess, for me. But no, just in the fact that how am I doing all of this with Leo? How can I incorporate this better as a mom, not even in a classroom setting? Because sometimes it's more challenging. Right. It's,
and oh my gosh, right. And humbling here on another part, because I don't have children. And so all of my personal experiences is a 45-minute classroom period. It's easy to say this. It's harder to practice it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But it's important to try. I also, going back to what you said earlier about, I don't remember exactly what you said, but it kind of like removes the novelty of it when they have it available. Yeah, the first time that you put out a sharpener for the class to use, they're probably going to use it constantly all day. And
all day. My gosh.
That noise. Yeah. And it will be terrible. It will be terrible. And I think that oftentimes people try these, they hear stuff like this and then they try it and they're like, well, I can't do this. This is miserable. But it's a little bit like potty training. The first couple of days are just miserable as they're peeing just all over the floor. And there's just urine in places in your house that you just never even considered that urine could be there. But
and once more, as a non-parent, oh my God, I'm not ready for some of these things.
Yeah. But it's this perspective, right? It's you have this long-term vision, this big picture view. A lot of the stuff that we do in the moment is not fun, is uncomfortable. Right. And we do it to set up things to be more productive and comfortable in the future. You like potty training and like using tools.
Right.
I've had in classrooms an actual woodworking bench mm-hmm. where there is actually tools available and used as one of the centers. It's
love it.
The first little bit is going to be hard because it takes so much effort to watch them. You have to have better ratios. You have to spend a lot more time on it. But then you have this whole new world opened up to the children and you can change them into different centers for lots of children. They, especially the younger you go, they get more into the fact that they love to unmake things. They love to destroy things. Maybe.
I'll never forget the first time I found out that kids about the age of two do that. And I was building sandcastles at my first preschool job and they would build them and just destroy them. And I was like, what's the point? Why are you doing this? Like, I was so frustrated.
Yeah. The repetition and like, and unmaking things. Maybe we should do an episode on that. But,
I'd love that.
But one thing that I did that I loved after my class had a grasp on these tools, then I started including different centers. I'd go to Goodwill and just get mm-hmm. a really cheap DVD player or something like that and have the children take it apart, something that I really didn't care about it being put back together. And yeah, it's
what a good life lesson too.
Yeah, it's so cool. And that sets up a bridge of where they start getting more curious to want to start creating things then. Start building things.
I have this very firm belief, and I'm not just being superfluous, that speaking of tools and why it's important to get early grasps of what interests you and what you're good at, there is no such thing to me as you are bad at art. There are so many kinds of art in the world. There has to be something that you can do because there are so many. And I always think of this child and his mother, I believe, designed naval ships. It was a pretty cool job. You'd always talk about that. I know, right? Like so specific, so interesting. And he was very intelligent in mathematical and science, and arts was kind of a rough point for him. He did not enjoy it too often because he was disappointed in the level of his drawing and painting abilities. Aww. We introduced, I know, right? Like those aren't the only arts. I hate that we often talk about them like they are. And we introduced a textiles based weaving activity to him. And it was creating a Mexican folk art evil eye, which anyone knows what that is. It is a really fun, simple craft where you weave around four points and it creates a great woven structure that is like a perfect, beautiful square design. And anyways, he did this project and he had it perfected within an hour. And it was so interesting to see how this science mind of his, this mathematical calculating mind, flipped that into the arts and flipped it into the specialization. He thought nothing of it. To him, it was so simple, but his friends could barely grasp this activity. Just coming to the fact that we can really hone other skills by introducing good tools, higher form activities to young children. I mean, it just, it opens so many pathways.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree. I actually, my conclusion talks about STEM a lot because that's what all of this is STEM. Mm-hmm. All right. Then we have physical, hand-eye coordination, strength, and fine gross motor control. I feel like all of that is very duh, you know.
It's duh, but it needs to be reiterated.
So cognitive, intellectual, it's mathematical thinking, size, shape, volume, measurement, directionality, geometry, engineering skills, creativity, and inventiveness. Then also I want to mention in here, what an amazing sensory experience a lot of these are going to be. Saws. Clearly, I love saws. I've been talking about them a lot in this. But think about a saw. So there's all the swirling dust that you see and smell, and even it gets in your mouth a little bit. You can taste it. There is the grating sound that you hear as the teeth go across and are removing the pieces of wood. Your hands feel the solid material that you're holding and feel the vibrations as the saw cuts. All of your senses are stimulated all at once. As you are doing something productive, it's really cathartic and has a huge impact. I love saws.
I know you do.
So we've talked about some of these, so I'll go through this pretty quickly. And tips for adults. So parents and teachers, if you want to implement specifically woodworking tools in your classroom or your home, which I highly recommend, you always have a discussion before using a tool. Mm-hmm. Kind of like you talking about the scissors, you need to talk about what the tool is called, what it is used for, how to hold it, and how to manipulate it, how to use it, and how to be safe with them. Use protective gear, such as goggles, work gloves, and talk about when they are required. They might not always be required. If you want to require it in your classroom or in your home, that anytime your child is using a riskier tool, that's not a problem. I would dissuade an overuse of gloves just because you honestly have a bigger risk as the child has less control over what they're using. When you put a barrier between them and the object, they're not going to get as much physical feedback. But if you have children and you're worried about them getting splinters, if that is a very large concern for you, go ahead and use gloves.
Right.
But anyways, use your discretion. Just go back and listen to our risky play episode and ask yourself those questions. But this is very Montessori inspired. We have Montessori to thank. Maria Montessori really pushed the use of child-sized materials. A child will fail at something using an adult material, but can accomplish the task very proficiently with a child-sized object or tool.
Right.
So if you can access a child-sized tool, use that one. If you are going to have tools in a classroom, this is not so much of a big deal at home. Your child to adult ratios tend to be better. Not every household, but especially in a classroom, you need to make sure you have proper ratios and bring in an extra teacher if you need to. Introduce one tool at a time. I talked about this when I went through the method that I did this. I do that because that is a safe way. This can be really overwhelming if you have a whole workbench full of tools that the child has never used before. That's going to be very overwhelming. They're not going to remember all of the different safety rules and the different ways to use them. So always introduce tools one at a time.
And on that note, keep the information simple for the tools more complicated, because I've personally run into that problem where you throw a lot out and you expect them to get it, and that it's not going to be that simple. And then really get into the details as you're actively engaging. Most children are experienced learners, not auditory learners. So just bearing that in mind.
Yes, I agree. That use hand over hand is the next one that I have.
Yes.
I would recommend this for almost, if it's a new tool to a child, almost 100% of the time. Older children, maybe not so much, but almost 100% of the time, I'm going to use hand over hand with a child to show
them. Hand over hand makes such a difference.
Yeah. Just for anyone who doesn't know, it's very well named, but where you put your hands on top of a child's hand and go through that motion with them to show them exactly what they should be doing with it.
Exactly.
We mentioned this, but it's really helpful to know the developmental capabilities of the ages that you work with so that you mm-hmm. can kind of cater the activities. You don't always have to go 100% all into it. You can kind of build up to some of these skills, especially we're talking about them being able to actually take care of the tools that they're using. And, you know, a 2-year-old not understanding the risk quite as well. That's great to use something more like use nails in a cork board so they're not concentrating so much on the force. Yeah. I've never used that one before. I found it on a list and I was like, that is
I never thought about that. Yeah.
Because then they're focusing more on just hitting the nail than actually the force of getting it in there. So good way to start practicing. Styrofoam and golf tees. Really, I've done that before. I've done that with fake hammers too. And for a younger child, that wouldn't be a bad way to introduce those. But when you can use the real thing, always opt for the real thing. And then always have examples and have things started with screws. And don't, unless you're working with older children, but I don't work with being early childhood. I don't work with children older than like first grade.
Right.
That, you know, they're not going to really have the ability to hold the screw in the right way and get it started. So I'm going to have all of the screws started and they just have to do the process of finishing it, have nails already hammered in. Just have an example of what you want them to do.
Precisely. Right.
Don't pull it out on a day that you are grumpy, you miss breakfast. Right. Don't pull it out on a day where the children missed breakfast or don't do it right before nap time or something like that. You have to be sharp when you're using these riskier objects.
You got to be sharp. That's pretty good. No, but really though, it's bearing in mind as well that this probably should not be doing whatever new activity you're learning. You should be doing it more than once. It shouldn't be a one-time little fun lesson because many things are not learned in a day. And we had a term we used in our finger strength, strong little fingers lesson, which was, some activities are practice resistant. They don't come naturally to us. And the only way we can hone them is by practicing them.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. I love that idea. Yeah. This is hard in different settings when you're not necessarily in charge of all your lessons. But where this was a really, really successful project that I got to have in this Compass setting. I've used tools in other preschool settings as well. But this was really successful because we were able to have it as a project and delve into it. And it was so cool. One of the wonderful things is letting it evolve and following the children as they go. And so we were able to really delve into this project. I did not start out with the plan of making this picture frame. I introduced these tools and figured we would just kind of use the tools, but the children were so invested and so engaged in it that it kind of just started happening. And yeah, they led this thing. They started making something from all their practice with the tools. And that's when I directed it a little bit more and we made it into a picture frame.
It was a beautiful project. Everything about it was so inclusive, and it really touched on the many hands that you dipped into with between nature and other learning accessories at the school.
Yeah. It was wonderful. But again, I've had access to a woodworking bench in a classroom before, but it's always a meaningful activity. I love the idea of not just doing a one and done, really introducing it and taking the time to see where it goes. And yeah, it's going to open up some magic. We are pushing STEM everywhere, but we're giving children prepackaged experiences.
Ooh, I like that.
So we got to stop with the prepackaged things. We have to let children be the little scientists that they are created to be and let them take on the roles of inventors, engineers, architects, artists, and let children have real experiences by allowing them the real tools needed to build those experiences.
We are giving them tools to use tools. It was cooler in my head.
Thank you so much for listening to The Speckled Bees, A Celebration of Childhood. We're just overwhelmed by the fact that anybody is listening at all.
Hearing that you're listening, whether you're messaging us on social media or approaching me in person, it's really a pleasure to know that we are gaining an audience of people just as devoted to education as we are.
And that we're part of a community that is all... just
the best community.
Yeah, the best community. So thank you so much. Please, if you are enjoying listening, please share with your friends and family. Tag us in your posts, especially if you use some real tools. Please tag us in your posts and let us see what you're doing. And let us be a part of your experience.
You should have a paintbrush by 2 weeks old. The grasp should begin at 3. And paint should enter the mouth with the breast milk by 4 weeks.